ever reached for a bottle of Visine or some similar product to clear up bloodshot eyes, you may have noticed those warnings on the package. Use them for more than a few days at a time, and the redness in your eyes may actually get worse. What was a solution ends up perpetuating the problem. Unfortunately, the same thing is true for one of America's favorite remedies for heat waves, air conditioning. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's no question when it's dangerously hot outside, refrigerated air can protect us from the very real risk of heat-related illness. But when the chemicals used to charge cooling systems escape into the atmosphere, as they inevitably do, they contribute to climate change even before we account for all the energy burned to make those systems work. And the U.S. uses more energy for cooling than all of Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East combined. Eric Dean Wilson is here to talk about this. He's author of the book After Cooling, on Freon, Global Warming, and the Terrible Cost of Comfort, and of a recent article for Time magazine titled Air Conditioning Will Not Save Us. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
We all know what air conditioning can do for us. It's been a brutal summer here in Texas. But can you start with a very basic explanation for us of how air conditioning works, how these machines turn warm air cold?
Sure. And I'll preface this by saying that I'm not an engineer or don't have a science background, but I did do a lot of research for this book, and it took me a really long time to figure out how it works, because I think for most of us, and this was my starting position, air conditioning is just kind of this magical thing that happens. You know, I grew up in the South where it was very hot and humid, and lived my life in air conditioning and never really thought about how it works. So the principle is pretty simple. It reacts on the idea that when liquid evaporates, when it changes from a liquid to a gas, it can absorb the heat and cool the air around it. And we've known this in Western science really since the 18th century. There were experiments in Scotland. Benjamin Franklin famously recreated one of the experiments and cooled the air in a vacuum-sealed tube in the late 1700s. But for a really long time, no one could really figure out how to harness these properties in the way that we think of them now as air conditioning. And one of the things that I discovered, which was quite a surprise to me, is that nobody really wanted to do that all throughout the 19th century. But the principle is pretty simple. So you take a refrigerant in the form of usually a liquid that can evaporate pretty easily, so what's called a volatile liquid, and using those properties of being able to easily evaporate at room temperature, what an air conditioner does is it evaporates it and then condenses it back into a liquid. And it absorbs a lot of the heat, and then the air conditioner blows that heat out of the exhaust fan. So usually like out into the front of the building or in the back, if you have like central air back of your house. And the result is cool air that's then circulated around the building. So that's basically how it works.
Aside from water used in evaporative coolers, I spent part of my teenage years in the desert, so I know how those work. But are all the refrigerant chemicals used in modern air conditioners implicated in global warming?
It's a great question. Not all of them. So the history of refrigerants came in a couple of waves. So before the 1920s, there was air conditioning. Really at the start of the 20th century. And it used refrigerants that were often either poisonous or explosive or sometimes both. So
it could be worse.
A great example is, movie theaters through the 20s were famously air conditioned. And if there was an ammonia leak, for instance, if you've ever smelled that, it's a very unpleasant smell, and it's very noxious, and it can cause people to, vomit and that sort of thing. It didn't happen all that often, but it could happen. And so all through the 10s and 20s, the engineering world knew that we needed a safe, reliable, stable, and also economically efficient refrigerant. And it would have to be manufactured. It was not something that we knew existed in nature, like carbon dioxide, which actually can be used as a refrigerant. So here comes the invention of Freon, or what was branded as Freon by DuPont. These are the famous CFCs, which were celebrated as being completely safe, which was a turned out to be a one of the world's cruel ironies, because they were directly responsible in the 1970s for the ozone hole, for blowing a hole in the ozone layer, which almost ended, and I'm not exaggerating here, almost ended all life on Earth. That story is a long one and one that I explore in the book, but the outcome was a good ending, thank goodness. We did not destroy all life on Earth. The ozone hole still exists, but it's recovering because mostly we've stopped the manufacture of these CFCs. So when that was discovered and being phased out by an international treaty called the Montreal Protocol, which, by the way, is still one of the most successful international diplomatic agreements, then new waves of refrigerants came in. So these refrigerants, HFCs and another form of them, HCFCs, which had been on the market for a little while, did not destroy the ozone layer, or at least did not to the degree that CFCs did. What was known at the time, but what was not really paid attention to, was that like CFCs before them, HFCs, which are still used in many, many, many air conditioners and cooling systems across the world, are super global warming gases. So these are sometimes thousands of times more better at trapping heat than carbon dioxide, which is by far the most prevalent global warming gas. I don't want to skew that. The number, the amount of CFCs and HFCs in the atmosphere is actually very small. But because they are so potent, they have a pretty sizable impact on global warming. So that shift to HFCs and the entire industry shifted, which is pretty remarkable, kind of locked us into a system of cooling that was producing these global warming gases. Now, if you know anything about air conditioning, you might think, well, what's the big deal? The refrigerant stays inside the air conditioner. Well, it's supposed to. But think about, you know, when you get rid of an air conditioner, oftentimes, you know, I live in New York City, and just walking around during the summer, it's not an uncommon sight to see air conditioners just smashed and lying on the sidewalk. It's illegal to do that, but that doesn't mean that people don't do it or just dumped illegally. And also, when you charge a refrigerant into a system, there's a lot of evidence that shows that over the course of about a decade, most of it leaks into the air because, you know, no system is a perfect closed system. So the problem that we're sort of in right now, which we're working towards solving, is to moving away from these super global warming gases, these HFCs. Now, we've passed an amendment to that great international agreement, the Montreal Protocol, which is beginning to phase down and hopefully phase out HFCs, but we're not there yet. So the irony is that in the second decade of the 21st century, we've come full circle. We're now sort of returning to those natural refrigerants that were once seen as very dangerous and actually are no longer that dangerous anymore, because with technological improvements, we can make sure that they don't leak as much, or we can improve the conditions for carbon dioxide as a refrigerant. So, I mean, the irony is that it's kind of a Ruby Slippers logic, like the best alternatives were there with us all along, you know?
But hang on here, Eric, because I know that CFCs and Freon, they've been, you know, the phase out has been decades long in this country, but I'll tell you, years ago, I had this old Honda Accord that I could not afford to replace. I had to keep running. The AC went out, and the guy at the garage said, well, I'm not able to, like, order a new whatever, but I got a guy, and I can charge this stuff up with you. How is it that some of these chemicals are still on the market when they're not supposed to be, at least in this country?
Absolutely. And, you know, that little anecdote is a window into a large part of the story that I explore in the book. So I never thought I would write a book about air conditioning, but the reason why I did was because of a close friend of mine. His name is Sam. I found out that I knew he was working for a green energy company, but I didn't know what he did. And we started talking one day, and as it turns out, his job was to drive around the United States and find Freon that still exists out there, just like the story that you said. that exists out there on the secondary market. So even though the production of Freon was banned by the Montreal Protocol, its use is not banned. So this isn't a black market, it's just a secondary market. And what was very curious to Sam and a lot of people who work on this project at first was, why is there so much CFC? Why are there so many CFCs still out there? And it's a little bit of a mystery, and some of the mystery I explore in the book. But there's a couple of reasons. I mean, CFCs actually are remarkably good at cooling because they were manufactured specifically for that reason. They do that job well. And of course, they also, you know, destroy the world. But what was really interesting to me was that Sam was meeting these people, like the person in your story, who had access to this Freon that they had been stockpiling or hoarding, or maybe just didn't know what to do with it. You can't just dump it because it's illegal, and not every landfill will take it. So a lot of people just held on to it and thought, maybe I can make some money off of this someday. And as it turned out, there were millions and millions of pounds of this spread over the United States. So part of the book is a journalistic road trip that I've taken with Sam to meet a few of his clients, and this is what really attracted me to the topic, who were people who often thought very differently about environmental goals or politics. So my friend Sam was a leftist, kind of environmental activist. He's a business person, but he also thought of himself as utilizing business in order to act towards climate goals. The people he met were often very conservative, distrustful of the EPA, global warming deniers, and often if they found out that Sam was going to buy the Freon, and I should say what he did with it. So he was buying up the Freon, and then he was destroying it in an ecologically responsible manner, so it can actually be passed through this super hot plasma furnace. And don't ask me how this works. I really don't know. it gets passed through a super hot plasma furnace that then breaks the chemicals down into basically salt water. And according to the website, this machine, which takes up the size of a sizable apartment, is 99.999 repeating percent energy effective. It's kind of a miracle process, and it takes a couple of days. And what Sam's company was doing was they were buying up Freon in the secondary market, destroying it through this process, and then getting carbon credits through California's cap and trade system. So they were utilizing that. So anyway, if the people who Sam was buying Freon from, if they found out that he was doing that, destroying the chemical, they would often not sell it to him because they thought that it was wasteful. They didn't agree with, quote unquote, the carbon guys. So I was super interested in this because here was somebody who, you know, in a time in which we're told we're more divided than ever, politically, people aren't speaking to each other, et cetera. Here was someone who was actually meeting people who are quite hostile to the very ideas that he was working towards. And in one instance that's explored in the book, a mind was changed and a friendship was forged, across very different backgrounds and very different political assumptions. And I found this very, very inspiring and became the core of spine of the book.
All right, Eric, on top of the issue of refrigerant contamination in the atmosphere, we have the energy question, right? Nobody uses power to cool off like the United States uses power to cool off.
That's right. That statistic that you cited, that's in the Time article, and also some of the statistics I found when I was researching this book, that the United States uses more cooling than certainly any other country, but more energy than some whole regions combined, was startling to me. I mean, I thought, this is interesting. And this is something that I feel just casually and anecdotally. You know, when I was working on this book, it happened dozens of times. I met people from elsewhere, often hotter places, Colombia, Ecuador, parts of China, etc. And the thing that they would tell me often is, you know, I grew up in this very hot place without air conditioning, and then I came here and everything's air conditioned, and now suddenly I can't live without it. So I thought, this is really interesting. There's something going on here that I feel like we're not exploring. That kind of led me to think about this energy question. Another way, in addition to refrigerants, another way that air conditioners are ironically making the planet hotter or harder to air condition, if you want to put it that way, is the energy that it takes to use them. So air conditioners use a notoriously large amount of energy. We can see this on very hot days when the peak electricity is bumped up by 70%, something like that. And we begin to have rolling blackouts. I mean, recently in Texas, this happened, right? You see that the vast majority of electricity that people are using in the home suddenly goes towards cooling. And this is would not be a problem if all of our electricity came from renewable sources. But unfortunately, obviously, that is not the case currently. So one of the ways that air conditioning is heating the planet is indirectly through the energy it uses. This is also a problem because right now the United States and Japan and maybe Australia are some of the most air-conditioned places in the world. However, that is swiftly changing. So areas that are far more population dense and that want air conditioning, and of course, because they, because we have air conditioning, you know, there's no reason why they shouldn't have it too. Places like China, India, Indonesia are beginning to build cooling infrastructures that are going to equal or rival ours. So what we're faced in the future, inevitably, is a world that is just going to jump up in terms of its cooling and also the energy that it takes to do that. There's been a lot of reports written on this, but we're kind of, this is really only just the beginning, and it's very concerning to think about what the future will look like. And, you know, I have an ethical problem with people saying, oh, the problem is, you know, China, Indonesia, India, these countries that are not nearly as air conditioned right now. The problem is them wanting air conditioning. I mean, how hypocritical is that, right? So what I chose to do in the book and also in the article is to turn the focus back on the United States, which the cooling problem began here. It is still one of the most air conditioned places on the planet. So I chose to kind of try to think about it in an American context rather than point the blame unfairly at someone else. You know, this raises a lot of questions that go far beyond air conditioning to our energy systems. You know, how is our electricity powered? How efficient is are the technological systems that are transferring the energy generation to the house, for instance? There's a whole lot of energy that's lost in that translation. Do we actually need to be cooled that much? You know, and this is not necessarily in terms of, I don't mean this just in terms of preference, but I mean this in terms of building design. You know, so much architecture in the United States and elsewhere in the, you know, so-called developed world is requires air conditioning. You know, skyscrapers are a great example. If you're on the 40th floor of a building, you probably can't open the windows, and it's designed that way, and so you need some kind of air to circulate. You know, if you're in Phoenix, if you live in Phoenix, Arizona, for instance, you probably can't live in the summer without air conditioning, and your building is probably not meant to circulate air freely because it's a very, very hot desert. So these are questions about design, because actually, if you're not in Phoenix, if you're in a place like New York, you can actually build a building that utilizes passive cooling techniques. So things like cool materials, utilizing cross breezes, shade, which, you know, is so simple, but actually makes a huge difference. All these things we often ignore. Historically have ignored through the 20th century when building things like office buildings in favor of a uniform, breezeless atmosphere. But one of the things I suggest in the article and in the book is that, you know, if we're really going to make it through these next, say, century, we need to rethink this, we might not need as much energy for cooling. You know, just to give a funny story, also when I was working on this book, so many people would tell me, wow, I can't imagine a world before air conditioning. And I would laugh at that and think, well, then you can't imagine a world before, like, say, I don't know, 1900. Right. You know, it's not that it's not possible to live through air conditioning. It's just that things, how we lived was very different. And I'm not suggesting that we go back to that world before, not at all. But that we think of it as an inevitability, as a necessity. And I'm challenging us to think of it instead as a kind of emergency tool. We should need to use it when we truly need it, but it shouldn't be the baseline, normal assumption for how we build buildings, how we live our lives. And that might mean that other things have to change. And I think that that's okay.
So we're going to get back to those alternatives in just a minute, but I do want to draw a line under the fact that heat, extreme heat, is in fact deadly. It is like the most lethal of the kinds of weather emergencies we have. And yet, cities don't go into overdrive preparing for heat waves the way they do for snowstorms.
Absolutely. Deaths from heat illness are by far the most dangerous climate-related disaster, more than floods, hurricanes. And that might come as a surprise to some listeners because we see on the news or on documentaries or movies, we see hurricanes and tornadoes and things like that far more frequently. So I think part of the danger of heat-related illness and extreme heat in cities is that it's very uncinematic, if I can say that. That might be a little strange, but I think it's true. You know, how do you show people with water bottles sweating, but other than that, it's not very kind of Hollywood ready. But it's actually the thing that's killing thousands of people across the globe every year. We just saw a horrible heat wave go through Europe and the UK, which is severely unprepared for this. And it's terrible, and it doesn't have to be that way. And one of the things that I talk about in the article is that rather than cities, and I focus on cities in the article, rather than cities leaving it up to citizens to decide whether or not to buy an air conditioner, whether or not to run an air conditioner, they need to actually step up and do something on the systemic or structural level. So a great example is something that happened a couple of years ago in Brooklyn while I was here. In 2019. And this happens in areas all across the United States. And I think is very telling to the way we kind of think about how our energy systems are organized. As I said before, you know, what happens on during heat wave? Well, everyone begins to turn on their air conditioner. A lot of times now, energy companies will try to preempt this and warn its customers to, lower the energy and that sort of thing. But I haven't really seen any evidence that that works. I mean, it relies on a kind of selflessness that I don't think is truly warranted. And then what happens? Well, you get rolling blackouts or you get, huge blackouts in the grid. And then the very thing that you're trying to use, the very tool that you're trying to use to cool, you can't use it. You can only use air conditioners if you have electricity, right? And also what we see again and again, this happened in the Pacific Northwest a few years back. It happened in Brooklyn in 2019, is that often the parts of the grid that fail or are deliberately shut off for to keep the integrity of the system as a whole are the parts that are, for instance, working class neighborhoods of color. And the reason for this are many, but they often don't make the city as much money. They're not the touristy areas. Like, could you imagine them shutting down Times Square, for instance, and think about how much energy that uses? And yet they're the ones that often act as the buffer zones. So what I try to explore in the article and also the book is that air conditioning is not the kind of universal tool for mitigating a heat wave that we think it does. You know, the people who can't afford it or who are in the neighborhoods who that don't get shut down, they can use it fine. The people who can't afford to buy one, who can't afford the electricity to run it, or who are in zones where these monopoly privatized energy companies that are acting as public utilities, which is how most Americans get their energy, those neighborhoods lose power altogether. So, you know, I don't think that this is a very good system for saving people if they can't actually use it. So, that's part of one of the ironies of air conditioning is that you can only use an air conditioner if you have the electricity to run it. And thinking in this country about, you know, subsidized energy or subsidized air conditioning for all in a country that doesn't see healthcare as a basic human right seems to me like probably a far-fetched idea. So what I'm interested in, as you said, is Not in, you know, banning air conditioning or in telling people not to use their air conditioners. I'm not interested in that at all. People should use them when they can, when they think they should, when they think it's dangerous. But what I'm interested in is actually saving lives. And I don't think that building a larger and larger energy infrastructure that leaves it up to individual choice of the citizens is actually doing that.
Eric, lots of people are familiar with the idea of urban heat islands, the fact that densely crowded urban centers are several degrees hotter outside than surrounding areas. It's even hotter in lower income neighborhoods sometimes. Why is that the case?
That's the case, and that, you know, that might seem a little strange at first. But it is the case because it's a result of generations of historical racism, specifically redlining. So again, I'm going to take New York City as an example, but this is true in lots of other cities across the United States, in the North and the South. You know, it, throughout the 20th century, and there's a great book on this, The Color of Law. And in that book, he talks about how racist lending practices would often keep neighborhoods either wholly white or just one race, sometimes only Jewish neighborhoods or only black neighborhoods, something like that. And this happened through the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and sometimes beyond, actually well into the financial crisis of the 2007 and 8. And these racist lending practices increased segregation, kept neighborhoods segregated racially, and also often in terms of class and income. And what happened then was that certain parts of the neighborhood were allocated resources and others were not. A great example of this is, for instance, trees and shade structure. So a really stark example in New York City is looking at the Upper West Side and then Harlem, just 20 blocks north of that. It's probably a 15-minute walk if you walk briskly, and the temperature difference is stark. In the Upper West Side, historically Jewish and white neighborhood, you have dense vegetation, large trees, pin oaks, things like that, that provide shade, that shade the asphalt, which absorbs heat and then releases it throughout the day from the sun. This keeps the neighborhood as a whole remarkably cool by several degrees, sometimes as much as 10 degrees. 15-minute walk north, you have a neighborhood where there's almost no trees lining the street, and the buildings are exposed to the sun directly. Brick buildings that are literally baking in the sun. This has a profound difference on how hot the buildings get. I mean, quite obviously, this is sort of just common sense. And, you know, in addition, what this means is that residents of the Upper West Side have way less trouble cooling their buildings than those in Harlem. So even though they're living in the same city just a few blocks away, the people in Harlem actually need more energy and thus more money to cool on the same day in a building. So what this is telling us is that those inequities that we know exist in lots of other ways, air conditioning is actually just exacerbating those unless we really address them as inequities and work to combat those. So that history of racist lending practices and segregation is actually still alive and with us today.
Do trees keep neighborhoods cooler just because of the shade, or is there more to it?
There's a little more to it. You know, this is such a delightful solution to it because it's, to me, it's a kind of win-win situation, and it's so simple, or it's kind of simple. I mean, trees take a long time to grow, so I guess that's not so simple. But so trees definitely shade, but they also do something else. They kind of act like nature's air conditioners. So what they do, even in cities, is that big oak trees will absorb water from the ground through its roots, and then that water will go up through the trunk and into the leaves, and the water will be used by the tree, but then evaporate through its leaves. And in evaporating, they do the same thing that more or less that air conditioners do. So basically, they are nature's air conditioners.
You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Jeannie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I like to stay cool, and especially when I'm sleeping. But I also have friends who like to wear a sweater when I like to wear something very cool. So obviously, cooling whole rooms seems to be kind of silly. Why hasn't someone come up with a way to cool us? And most particularly, like when we're sleeping, why can't we have sort of a canopy system that cools our bed area and leaves the rest of the room? I mean, we're cooling 16-foot high ceilings in 5,000 square foot rooms or houses. It seems like a tremendous waste.
Thank you so much for your call. What do you know about that, Eric?
That is such a smart comment, Jeannie. And, you know, it reminds me that there's a great air conditioning historian named Gail Cooper who writes, we're in the habit of cooling spaces, not people. And it should be the other way around. And, you know, I think that's right on the money. My example for that is like the Astrodome, which, you know, is totally air conditioned. And I don't know how many percentage of that is not people, but it's huge. It's probably like 95%, right? So that's a question really for designers. And I think it's a question that a lot of designers are not asking. You know, there's a lot of studies that have been done recently about office buildings. And there's an engineering standard that says that more than 80% of occupants should be, that the design should make more than 80% of occupants comfortable. And there have been lots of surveys and studies that have shown that this is not the case at all. It's more like 10%. So mostly people are very chilly. And, you know, the reason for that is that a lot of times employers will crank up the AC in order to make people more alert, or, you know, worried about people falling asleep at the job or something like that. That's a gross generalization, but there's a lot of sort of evidence out there about that. So, you know, but also you raise the question of, you know, how do we cool a space so that everybody in it is comfortable? It makes me think of my grandparents. I remember my grandmother used to stand up and walk over to the thermostat, and then she'd go sit down. And then 5 minutes later, my grandfather would walk over to the thermostat and then turn it right back to where it was before.
Right.
And they did that all night. I don't have any clear answers about that, but there are some kind of fashion or wearable technologies that are emerging, you know, things you can, vests or things you can put on your arm and things like that. And that may very well be the future.
So my house is old and it's located in Dallas, Texas, but it was built before anybody had air conditioning. And, you know, you look around and the design is really different. Like, we've got these deep porches that are shading all of the downstairs. Upstairs, there's, you know, shade from these overhangs. Why did we stop making houses like that, especially in warm parts of the country?
You know, there's a couple of reasons, and I think they're intertwined. I mean, one is that I think there was a need for housing after World War II, population and housing boom. And so there was a need to throw up a lot of cheap, quick housing. So good, you know, sustainable design would be an anachronism. Nobody was really thinking about that at the time. These cheap materials can get hot really fast. And so that was part of what the change was. And then the other part, I would argue, was air conditioning itself. You know, the invention, air conditioning as a in the house, in the domestic sphere, didn't really take hold until the end of the 50s. It had been around for almost half a century, but it was exclusively in places like the movie theater or marketplaces or offices. And so there was the potential for a booming market of housing that included things like central air. And so housing began to be built that actually required air conditioning. So that's part of my sort of critique, is that what if we stopped relying on air conditioning as a necessity and instead designed as if we didn't need it? and maybe could choose it, because in most of the places in the United States right now, buildings built after World War II, you actually need it.
So when you mentioned in your Time article that we use more AC than all of Latin America and Africa and the Middle East combined, those are hot places. I mean, I recognize that there may be more people living in poverty there who don't have the option, but what are some of the things people do to stay cool in those very hot climates?
Well, you know, I think some of the things we've already explored, shade structures, also some of those places are not necessarily as metropolitan, so people can spread out. But I think something that we haven't talked about and something that should be addressed is also that is kind of behavioral. So this kind of goes back to the idea that you brought up, that when we have a heat wave, a lot of cities don't really act like it. You know, we don't necessarily send out, the city doesn't go into emergency mode or evacuation mode or something like that in the way that it does with a hurricane. We're expected to continue with our lives in exactly the same way, to go into work, for some of us to work, you know, an 8 or more hour day at the office in the blazing heat. A lot of these other parts of the world that don't have air conditioning do not do that. And most of us don't have the luxury of telling our boss, oh, I'm sorry, I can't come into work today. It's really hot outside. but this is another sort of shift in really, and I'm talking about systemic thinking here, you know, and really systemically thinking about dealing with these in ways that don't necessarily rely on a technology that's going to hurt us even more. You know, to take a very simplified example of it, this is where the siesta comes from, right? I mean, you have cultures that traditionally a nap during the hottest hour of the day is part of their culture. And, you know, there's a reason why the United States and Japan are currently some of the most air-conditioned places in the world. And it's because we also have the most amped up work cultures. And we're expected to work 24 hours a day. So I think that that's a really unaddressed part of it that we haven't talked about so far. And I think in a lot of these, it's not that people don't work in those other areas, but they don't have that kind of always on, you know, 24/7 sort of work ethos that is seen as righteous, really, frankly, in the United States.
We also have a real bias against sweating. Like, you're allowed to sweat and let other people see that if you're full on working out and everybody knows it. But otherwise, somehow our culture has decided that's socially unacceptable, even though it's just the human body's way of surviving.
That's right. Yeah. You know, thinking about, again, in New York, riding the subway with people, I watch all kinds of people trying to, on their way to work, you know, in business suits and dresses and high heels, powdering their face, trying to make themselves look like they're not sweating. And I think part of it, too, is the kind of cultural acceptability of just kind of looking a little bit like a mess, you know, in, you know, 90 degree weather and being OK with that. The body is actually quite efficient at cooling itself if you give it the space. So, you know, I see businessmen in three-piece suits on Wall Street walking during 90 degrees. That is, there's nothing logical about that. And, you know, there's nothing that says that we should have that. So thinking about fashion, you know, material design, and also allowing the sweating mechanism, which, again, acts kind of like the body's air conditioner. You produce sweat, and then it evaporates, if you let it, from your skin, which is a lot harder to do in the humidity. But if you're in a dry place, it works remarkably well. And a lot of our kind of social, cultural norms actually inhibit us from doing that.
In your Time article, Eric, you mention Con Ed, which is the monopoly utility serving your part of the country, you know, making these decisions about where to cut power when there's not enough in the summer. Why is it that you think that transferring ownership of these privately held utilities to public corporations would make a difference? Or publicly owned corporations?
I'm glad you asked that. I mean, this is maybe something that will, you know, feel like the most controversial part of what I've been talking about today, which is a real change in the way we get our energy, and not just from renewable sources, but in the system that we use. So more than two-thirds of Americans still receive their energy from these kind of monopoly private companies that used to be things like, from the heyday of the 20th century, these sort of monopoly companies that were then broken up and now are still these private companies that act as public utilities. And one of the reasons that I'm really wary of thinking that they can get us out of this mess is that because they are private utilities that act as public utilities and not actually public utilities, their MO, their most important thing that they're worried about is the bottom line, is profit. And one could argue that if you are saving people and giving people energy, then that's the most profitable thing and those things are intertwined. But I think when you allow unprofitable parts of the city to go off the grid in order to save the integrity of the system as a whole, I mean, it's a pretty clear indication that that the needs of public health are not put before profit in that instance. I think that energy should be controlled and handled in the hands of those who use it. And there's lots of projects around the world that are leading the way on this. Community solar projects in the city and also in rural parts. I have a friend who is kind of scheming to do this in Woodstock, where he has a house, to kind of get neighbors together, put up solar panels, and then generate their own electricity and then sell it to companies. And obviously, private companies don't want this because it puts them out of business. But I think that if this is a matter of life and death in the future, how we get our energy, and I think it is, we should have a major say in how we control that and how that is distributed to our neighbors.
How should we make decisions about how cool we need our environments to be so we don't get sick from the heat, and the difference between that and how cool we want our environments to be so we can not even think about it?
That's a really hard question. And, you know, part of the problem that we have now, I think, is that we've become, it's become very difficult to distinguish between discomfort and danger. I always encourage people to try it out a little bit in a safe way. You know, when I first moved to New York, I didn't think that it didn't even cross my mind to live without air conditioning. And I have been remarkably surprised by how little I need it, so much so that I had to run to a Target earlier today, and I walked into the Target and just cold air blasting in my face. And for a second, I thought, wow, this is really unpleasant, because I'd been in my apartment, which doesn't have any air conditioning, for the past couple of days. But one of the things that can really help is for cities and maybe the government itself too, to be much better at educating us on the signs for heat distress. One of the major causes of heat-related illness and heat-related death is isolation and also not understanding what those signs of heat death are. So if you're a little bit itchy or comfortable, or, you know, a little bit tired or something, that's really discomfort, and there are ways to mitigate that. If you're feeling confused, dehydrated, the edges of your vision are blacking, things like that, that's an entirely different story, and you need to seek help immediately. I think one of the most interesting kind of statistics is that, a sociologist named Eric Klinenberg studies this through his book Heat Wave, is that a lot of people who are most vulnerable to heat waves are those who are living alone. And so one of the things that we can really do is to check in on our neighbors, make sure that they are taking care of themselves, to make sure that we're taking care of each other. Because again, what I'm afraid of is that the kind of individual response, I have air conditioning, so I'm okay. That's really not helping us as a community. And one of the things we can be better at is checking in on our neighbors, especially those who are older and most vulnerable to this crisis, because it is a heat crisis.
Eric Dean Wilson is author of the book After Cooling, on Freon, Global Warming, and the Terrible Cost of Comfort. Eric, thanks so much for making time to talk with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we're at KERA Think. If you want the podcast, you can subscribe to it free wherever you get your podcast just by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.